Let's talk about the treasure of the mind, this magnificent ability to do incredible things. Stand by, Gerald Epling is with us next as we talk about the power of the mind next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about our now special guest. Gerald Epling is an expert in memory formation. He received his bachelor's degree in computer science, master of science degree in applied cognition and neuroscience, doctor of philosophy degree in cognition and neuroscience from the University of Texas at Dallas. Gerald's work includes research into memory formation, states of consciousness, phenomenal biocommunication as well. He has at least 20 years plus of experience with all kinds of electronic endeavors, including signal detection, communications, optoelectronic instrumentation. Gerald, you've done it all.
Oh, thank you. I've done a lot. It's been a challenging life, but I've not done it all. I've got a lot further to go.
You have been with us for a long time. The last time I had you on, though, was about, what, 3 years ago?
It was. It was May of 2013.
My gosh. Time flies. Yes. What have you been doing since we last talked?
Well, since that time, I did some medical research and planned some clinical trials. And it was interesting because there was a potential for a placebo effect. So I was told the clinical trial wouldn't have a placebo. We would just go ahead and look for this effect, and it would be fine. And I designed the experiment. By designed, I mean I worked out the mathematical model. And then at the last minute, they changed it and said, you know, we want a placebo group too. I said, okay. I said, this is a four-week experiment. Said, yeah, but, you know, we're going to read the blood. How could the placebo really affect that? And I said, well, you know, it could.
And explain the placebo effect.
Oh, the placebo. Placebo means to please you. So when a person's pleased, they start producing all of these wonderful hormones and neurotransmitters, and life starts going their way, so to speak. Amazingly, In this particular study, we would take blood and look for specific cells, and the exact cells that the active ingredient group had increased, which we expected, also increased in the placebo group.
Wow.
Yes, and up to week three, it was looking really bad. But then at week four, there was a separation. You know, that's why we like to go to 6 to 9 weeks if you've got a placebo. At week four, we got the separation. It was a good study, and oh, we made it.
And that placebo effect is basically, if you believe it, it will be. Is that pretty accurate?
That's exactly right. You have a faith, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things that are not seen. You believe that this is going to happen. And you don't have to say you believe it so much. You just have to, actually really believe it.
It's all in the mind, isn't it?
It really is. The mind is such a fabulous place, and it helps us do everything that we do. I know someday we won't have a mind, and they say you have past lives, but I really enjoy exploring the mind now. There's so many things you can do with memory.
If we had to categorize a title for you today, Gerald, today, what would you like to call yourself?
Somebody who helps other people with personal development.
But you're not a sociologist, right? You're not a psychologist.
Well, I am a psychologist. I'm a nationally certified psychologist.
Oh, are you?
Oh, and a board-certified clinical psychotherapist.
Well, good for you.
Thank you.
Do you practice that a lot?
I do not. I'm not in practice, and I do other things. Work more in the commercial world.
Because you are such an expert in the mind,
yes.
What is it about that that fascinates you so much?
There's so many things. The fact that people don't see things the same way, even colors. Some people can't see red. If you look at a red on a black background, for them, it looks black. And there's such a variation in what reds people see, what blues, so that's interesting. And the way people hear varies quite a bit. And the way people put things together, is very, very different. But yet, underneath it all, we all have very similar brains. That's why medicine works. We all have things in common. But what can we do? This is the question that keeps me going, is what can we do to get the most out of the brain that God gave us and to benefit others around us and to make this world a better place? So that's what I'm really interested in.
Now, when you say use the brain to make this a better place, which would be great, it would be ideal, yeah. How would we do that? How would we apply that?
Okay. You would want to look for things that you might be able to do that aren't being done, looking for the holes, looking for the spaces between the things that are happening, and then find a way to bring those about. That's kind of a rough sketch of what you would do. Focusing more narrowly, I have found that what I've learned about the brain and the brain systems helps a lot of other people understand why they have trouble with stress or anxiety or
wanting to kill themselves. I mean, I've had calls from people, Gerald, who have been so depressed that they're ready to end their lives. I had a guest on last night who got ripped off by his brother to the tune of several million dollars. He contemplated suicide three times.
Right.
Now, that's got to be a stressed-out, depressed person.
You have got it. You've got it. What the best thing to do for that person is, of course, you might want to talk to somebody about this, because there are other people who've walked down that valley, and they can walk with him and walk him out. There's a time when a person's so low, the best thing you can do is come visit and just sit with them. Eventually, you like to get things out on the table, because when it comes out on the table and it's in the open, it's not so scary. It's not such a big problem. As you think about it and you get depressed, it looks like an insurmountable challenge, what may not be an insurmountable challenge. The good news is we're here and we have everyone in our ancestors, every one of our ancestors made it. They all made it. We've got proof of it because we're here. Very good chance we will be here tomorrow. The sun will rise and things will go on. If we just keep going forward, getting a lot of sleep is good if you're depressed. Not 8 hours a night is a good amount. Rest is so important. At night, when you rest, the brain is cleansed. The cells move around a little bit, and the cerebral spinal fluid goes through the brain cells and clears out some things. And it gets this deep regenerative rest that you can't get at cat naps. So it's really good if you're depressed to get some sleep. And the other thing is find something to focus on, something that you know you can do that is good, beneficial. Go to a library and read to children. There are children out there that need someone to read to them. They haven't developed the skills for whatever reasons of listening and reading, and you can help them read. And look at what you can do and think about what it would be like if you weren't there. You know, the child would have no one to read to them.
That's like my George Bailey story, of course, from It's a Wonderful Life. If he died, if he tried to do himself in, how many people's lives would have been affected with him gone?
Exactly right, George. Exactly. You don't know how many, but it would be a lot. And it doesn't end when a person kills himself. The people around them feel really bad. Now, often a person who's in deep depression doesn't get their mind out of their own trouble enough to realize how much they would be missed and how sad everyone would be who knew them that they were gone. So, you know, get out, talk to people, go have coffee with somebody. Coffee's great. I love coffee. It's also a slight stimulant. These are things for the depressed, and seek professional help if you think you might kill yourself. You can go to a medical doctor, talk to them. Doesn't have to be a psychiatrist or psychologist necessarily. You might want to start with a friend, but reach out, talk to people. Try to look beyond what's bringing you down. And if you do something, you can change the way you think. I have a Hawaiian shirt. Whenever I'm writing and I'm doing a really interesting part of the book that I enjoy, I put on my Hawaiian shirt And it's just like I'm back in Honolulu, you know, and the waves are coming in and it's a nice day, good breeze. Do something that changes up your environment somehow. Those are good things to do.
Tell me a little bit about Brain Basics.
Okay, Brain Basics is a book where I look at the brain systems and I start writing them down. I started writing them down so that everyone can have a look at what you see when you go and do medical research or work as a neuroscientist. But it's not in the detail that you get. You don't. It's like getting all of the icing without having to bake the cake. I show in generalities where these systems come together. A system that was discovered around the 1990s that is really interesting. It's called the default mode network. Now, George, this network goes offline when a person focuses their attention. So here's the challenge to the expert that's imaging the brain. We want you to read these words and remember them. Okay, so they're kind of daydreaming until they get started, and there's something going on. But the minute they start, all that drops out. So to the guy doing a word study, that's noise. We don't care. They only go for what they need to show which parts of the brain would be engaged by the particular task. But then back to the default mode network, if you think about it, it goes away. So you have to be very clever in how you image that. It turns out a lot of the brain is doing some activity when we're not thinking about it, when we're not reading the clock or driving a car or reading a book, daydreaming. Beta waves are engaged. There's some gamma waves. Theta is interesting. These are waveforms that are associated with imagination and remote viewing. The gamma waves are really high frequency waves, and they're just other ways to describe what's going on in the brain. So this default mode network has to figure in anytime you're looking at memory, because we know with memory, you can study something, learn it. If someone asks you right after you've read it, you won't know as much as you will a little while later after the memory is consolidated. You can show people a series of line drawings and then give them a slight distractor task, ask them how many they recognize, and you'll find that if they don't get enough time to consolidate that memory, they don't remember as many items. So something's going on. We used to know that it was there. We didn't know what it was. Now we can point to the default mode network and say, I think that's where it is. And that's just one of the systems that we can work with. There's a system, about a 20-minute system, that relates to stress. And there's a system of hearing that takes, well, maybe 6 seconds. When you hear someone talk and they're saying, hey, you know, you should probably get out of the house because it's on fire. And then they walk off. You could look up from your paper, replay it, and say, oh, good idea, and leave, because you've got about a six-second buffer. So these are good systems to know. It's good to know the limits and how you can use them.
Do you do any work with deja vu to explain what that is?
I have some ideas about that. I've been dabbling with remote viewing for a long time. I've started to look into it a little more. A really plausible explanation I heard someone posit is perhaps these are glimpses of the future, sort of future memory. And that may be the case, and that's sort of the way I'm leaning. A lot of people wouldn't go there, but there is that. And then there is a deja vu that comes when people do the same thing over and over again. And I'm not sure that's deja vu as much as just remembering, oh, yeah, at this time yesterday I got up and put on the toaster or something. So those are the two things that I see in deja vu. How about you, George?
Well, it's lately I've been having a lot of deja vu episodes. I haven't had it happen in years, but lately it's happened like 4 or 5 times in 2 days. It's really, really weird. You know, it's almost as if I'm out of a time sink with myself, and that I'm a step ahead of myself somehow. Maybe I'm in another universe. I don't know. It's strange.
Have you read Breakthrough to Creativity by your Aunt Shafika?
Oh, of course.
Regula?
Of course.
It's, Isn't that a great book?
Yes. She was a pioneer.
She was. I still use that as a reference to see what she was thinking about certain things and to see how they're playing out. Fascinating person.
She devoted her entire psychiatric career to investigating the paranormal, telepathy, clairvoyance. She went into that in a big way.
How about sappers? I was reading about sappers in her book.
Energies, energy sappers?
Energy sappers, yes.
Now, well, they're out there. What about them?
They are. That could be something that can bring you down. Shafika Kregula gives one example of a woman who would go to a party, and she would sit down, and she would look not happy, furrowed brow, pensive look on her face. Not talk to anybody, and people would go around and talk, and then she would become filled with energy, feeling better and better and better and better. And at the end of the night, she would thank the host for inviting her and say how wonderful it was.
But everybody else had a great, horrible time with her.
They did. They did. She did not get invited back. I'm sorry, it's Dr. Kregula, but I've read the book so much, I think of her as, you know, someone, a colleague or so. I've never met her. But
well, she's dead now.
She did. She is. She's gone.
Yeah.
Like Cleve Baxter. Gone.
Yeah, I wanted to talk with you about Cleve, too.
But
you know, I don't think these energy vampires, as I call them, I don't think, Gerald, they know what they're doing specifically. Maybe some do. Maybe some need to feed off people energetically, and they go out and do this on purpose. But I think a lot of them don't get it. I've talked about a story of a guy in St. Louis named Andy that could clear out a bar the moment he walked in, and he never understood why. He was a nice guy. You know, there was nothing mean about him at all, but he'd go in, he'd sit at the bar, and everybody at a packed bar would leave him. You know, he'd be the only one sitting there within 10 minutes. And I saw this happen to him time and time again. And one day I walked up to him because I said, this guy's got this psychic vampire thing about him and doesn't even know it. And we would just talk. And I'd say, Andy, how you doing? He says, well, honestly, not well. And I said, why? And he said, well, you know, people seem to, you know, get away from me. I can't seem to hold a conversation. I can't seem to have a relationship. You know, I'm just down on myself. And I told him, I said, why don't you just try to change things for yourself? You know, be more positive about stuff instead of negative.
Right.
And a couple weeks later, I ran into him again, and he's at the same bar, except this time there were people around him. And he looked at me, and he kind of winked, and I said, it's working, isn't it? And he said, it sure is. And he actually had people talking to him. And I think I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but I think he changed that by changing some kind of energy in his system. What was that though, Gerald? What did he change to make that work? Think about that. We're going to hit this break, and then we're going to come back in a moment as we talk about anything from psychic vampires to the placebo effect and so much more. And don't forget, you can always like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter because you get lots of information that way. And always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Gerald Epling. And we're talking about all kinds. We're going to get into Cleve Baxter. It's an incredible story about him. But back to these psychic vampires, Gerald. Have you witnessed them as well?
Oh, yes. I have definitely witnessed them. In the business world, you do see them. And often they have the sort of altruistic bent. They want to go and do something that's good for mankind, but they're frustrated. And I think maybe that depresses some. That can, if you want to do something, you never make it. That's not good. But just like your friend Andy, it may be something they're missing. Maybe they need a Hawaiian shirt or George Norrie to come and give them a tip.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. Yeah. Something to change that black cloud effect that they carry over themselves.
Yes.
Oh. I can't wait for calls because I'm going to solicit people who have witnessed psychic vampires to give
that
us buzzes.
That would be interesting.
So our dear friend Cleve Baxter, God rest his soul, passed away 3 years ago. He died a month after you were on the program, Gerald. You talk about synchronicity, but tell us a little bit about him. I mean, he was—he worked for the CIA. He did experiments with plants. I think one of his experiments, and he wrote, he was on the show with me a long time ago. He investigated talking to plants that they talked back. But tell us a little bit about him.
Okay. Yes, he served in the United States Army. I believe it was World War II. Just a wonderful American. He taught police how to use lie detectors. He would teach whoever wanted to know. I believe he did have some dealings with the CIA. I may have read something about that, but I don't know.
He was an interrogation specialist with the CIA.
He was an interrogation specialist. The way that game's played is you get somebody in a room, you get them a little bit uneasy. And that's not hard to do when you're putting a little tape around their chest and little electrodes on their arms and perhaps the leg and wiring them up. People start getting a little nervous. And then you pick some questions that you can ask that maybe will throw them off guard. And then a question that you want to know the answer to. That's the sequence you might set up. The initial questions you might ask them, you know, what's your name, what's your birthday, maybe have them tell you a false thing so you can see how they respond. And in Cleve's era, they had these big machines they would bring in that were all manual. He had to adjust the potentiometers and everything to synchronize his system to that person in the chair. And he was such an expert at that. So it's an interesting thing. Most people, if you have a good interrogator, can take that person down a road where they actually will show a big difference when they're lying from when they're not lying. And one night in the 1960s, he was at his office, I believe it was in New York, and I have a book. That's how I've come by this knowledge. I did talk with him a little bit, not very much. He did write a nice note to me in the book about continuing. He was glad I was doing biocommunication. That was very nice. But Cleve had the idea that this Dracaena might show some sort of a signal as the water moved up the stalk. So he wired up his machine to the Dracaena, and he put some water in it, and it worked right away. It showed this energy that it was having, and it was so fast, he realized this is not water coming up the stalk. This is electrophysiology. This is a living something right there that just responded to being watered. He watered it again, and it wasn't much of a response, and again, there was no response. It went flat. So right away, it responded. Later, it didn't. I later found out why that was. That's another story. So he was working with the Dracaena, mm-hmm. and he got these responses. Then he thought, wow, what else could I do? So he started wiring up all sorts of things. He wired up rhododendrons, other plants. He had a background in plant science, horticulture, at the practical level. Very practical man, Cleve Baxter, as I understand him. And then he sort of expanded it a bit. He started looking for things that might be alive that you couldn't really tell, like a chicken egg. And he wired up a chicken egg to his equipment and then went and took another chicken egg far away from the chicken egg that was wired up, and he dropped it in boiling water. And when he dropped it in boiling water, he noted the time. He went back and he looked at his chart. And sure enough, the chicken egg that was not boiled, that was sitting where he put it, showed a spike when the other chicken egg was dropped in boiling water. Pretty interesting stuff.
Sure was.
Yeah, and that was a technique that I took a little time learning. I didn't pick up on that right away, and Cleve helped me personally to get that technique down, because I had never hooked a chicken egg up to the electroencephalograph before. But I mastered it with himself. Then he finally progressed to where he found he could take some saliva, process it. He had help from some other people who showed him how to do this. He processed the saliva. He had it in a tube, and he would hook up his machine to that tube while the person went about their business. That person could hop a plane and fly somewhere else, get off, get some bad news, and back in Cleve's lab, that processed saliva would show the stress that person was under. Now that takes a while to soak in, or it did for me. I actually, to really get my mind around it, I built the instrumentation I thought would be just ideal for that. And then I used it, and I duplicated some of his research with plants and some of his research with other things. And I expanded them in different ways.
His work with plants, Gerald, was absolutely amazing, where he concluded that plants feel pain. And that's absolutely amazing. I wonder how the vegetarians feel about that now.
Well, now here's a good note for the vegetarians. The first experiment I did to see if it would work or not, I made a little device that was inexpensive that would give me a response. I thought, well, Baxter is getting this, and he probably is because he has really good data, and people don't forge that much data. If they do, they don't do it that well. But I still wanted to make sure before I devoted a year worth of studies to get into developing my own equipment and going down that road that it was something I could do. You know, for all I know, Cleve's special. I don't know. That's what I was thinking at the time. So I made this little instrument, and I put it on a plant that was in my garden. And I picked off another leaf, and I ate it. Plant did not care. Plant was like, hey, I'm a plant. Fine. No problem.
No issues.
No issues. No problems. I couldn't get a rise out of the plant. So I left the garden, and I went into my kitchen, and I was thinking, well, you know, maybe the electrodes are too small. And this was the inexpensive version of the test equipment. I was using aluminum foil. And then I remembered, no, you know, you don't need a lot of aluminum foil. You don't need a big connection. And then I thought, I know, Cleve burned that plant. I'll burn it. George, the instant I thought that I would burn it.
It went nuts, didn't it?
It went nuts.
Yeah.
It went nuts.
It picked up thought patterns.
It picked up the thought. And I went out and I burned it so I would complete the experiment. And then I felt so bad I never did it again. and Cleve replicated that experiment late in his life. And so a lot of the work Cleve's done has been replicated by other scientists. It is out there now. So, yeah, fascinating work.
What does that tell you, though? What can you conclude by the fact that if he's right, that plants respond to stimulus, that they could feel pain, does that tell you that, you know, they're intelligent, that they can communicate? I mean, would they, you know, if somebody's coming to pull a piece of celery out of the ground, it screams to the other celery? I mean, what happens?
I don't think it would really scream as long as the user was considerate about pulling it up. And the plant, it does go into a sort of a state of numbness if it gets too much pain. So obviously, you know, I think they can feel, because I just said pain. But the plants, I think that they do sense what's coming their way. I think that bugs attacking them, certainly they develop different chemical responses to bugs to try to get rid of them. I think they don't like to be eaten by bugs. And I think they do sense pain, but I don't know about the intelligence part. I know that I have a lot of indications that they respond to thoughts and actions. Oh, the Dracaena story. Dracaenas don't like to be watered very often. My Dracaena like to be watered about every 7 to 10 days. And when I first watered it, that's when I got the response. And there's an interesting drought-related story with that, too. I was in Texas at the time that I was doing a lot of this Dracaena research. And when we started getting a drought, we started getting really dry before the drought was really recognized, the Dracaena responses diminished greatly. And they were low all through the drought. And I gave that plant to a neighbor and moved somewhere else. But that was a remarkable thing about the different places I've lived recently, the desert where the plants are just not nearly as responsive. And recently, I moved to Oklahoma. I had some indications that we would have the drought ending. The indications were pretty clear to me by 2014, so I made sure to position myself here by 2015. And they were having a bad drought, and sure enough, it ended. They had plenty of rain, and all the plants are happy. So there are some interesting things that I learned through that whole plant experimentation.
That's remarkable. It really is. I mean, it may tell you that the life source is everywhere now. Everywhere.
Yeah, it is.
And I'm convinced, you know, insects, animals, like plants, they feel it too, don't they?
I think they do. I think they do. It changed me deep down inside when I realized that plant was responding to what must have been a painful stimulus. I'm more appreciative of my vegetable salads and other things that I eat, knowing how things are.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
it's not just that cow that gets us slaughtered for humankind anymore.
That's right.
I mean, I wonder, you pick a tomato off the tomato plant. I wonder if it hurts it.
No, I'm not sure about that. I did not monitor. I did find one interesting thing, though. You know, Cleve was looking at things related to the polygraph approach, which is where you stress people, you stress things, and you get responses. Pioneering work. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. I don't know anybody else that had before Cleve did that. But I tried to sort of slip over to the other side and see what it would be like if a plant was happy. I got some tomatoes and some bell peppers. When you mentioned tomato, it reminded me of this. And I removed the bell pepper leaf and hooked it up to my sensing device while I went out into the garden one day and planted three tomatoes and three bell peppers. And as I planted each plant, there was a response. For the tomatoes, it was an upward, sort of a good, happy-looking response. And with the bell peppers, it was slightly larger. And when I planted the bell pepper plant that I'd taken leaf off of, it was the largest of all. So that told me that these plants can give positive and negative responses. I did other things that showed positive responses when a plant is pollinated and things like that. So then I continued that on and worked with things like spirulina, these cyanobacteria. You know, these are great things. They live in the oceans. They live in the fresh water. They give us oxygen. Very responsible for the planet being such a nice environment where we can breathe. And so I found things that make these blue-green algaes happy. And that was an interesting research, too. So there's a lot that can be done both ways. You can see when a plant's stressed. You can see when harm's coming the way of that plant. It will sense it before. You can see when the drought's coming. And you can see it when the drought's going to end. And in the plants.
I guess you don't want to tick off a Venus flytrap, that's for sure.
No, what if it ever grew up?
They bite back. That's right.
Yes.
Little Shop of Horrors. Remember that play?
I remember that. Funny show.
So with you, Gerald, I mean, when you assemble all this information, what do you do with it? I mean, you've got a book out called Treasure of the Mind. You've got the basics book, books, Brain Basics, coming out. What do you do with the information?
Some of the information I provide as a consultant to people in different industries, but my heart is really for personal development, for doing things that will help people have a happier life or a better life. Things like the blue-green algae. It's good for people. So it's good to know how to make that and how to grow it. And knowing what the system is for stress, knowing that stress, when it comes on you and your heartbeat goes up, your blood pressure goes up, it's probably going to be up for 20, 30 minutes because that's part of a hormonal system that takes 20 or 30 minutes to cycle. But you can change your thoughts in an instant. So it's good to know the different systems. I think as a personal development and organizational development sort of skills, those are things that I like to apply.
You have looked at something called energy psychology. What is that?
I have. That is fascinating. That is a take on psychology that acknowledges the fact that we have electromagnetic fields around us, and they acknowledge there may be other fields, and they actually have procedures to manipulate those fields, which I think is really wild. So I have looked at energy psychology for me it was a long time, for almost a year. Usually I decide and do something much quicker than that, but I was very busy with other things at the time. But in 2014, I decided I would go to the Energy Psychology Conference. It was a wonderful experience. I met several like-minded people, and I learned some techniques. I decided to buckle down and take several workshops. And then I took away what I learned from those workshops, applied it for a year, and I went back and took some more studies, another workshop, and then I could say that I'm trained in applied energy psychology. And this shows you how to tap on certain areas of your hand if you feel that you need to sort of ground yourself, become more focused. They show the meridians in different areas of the body and where there are focal points that you can tap that will affect how you feel. I think that this is the shortcut to therapy for a lot of people who would not ever get therapy otherwise, and it's a shortcut to therapy for people. And people don't get therapy for a lot of reasons. You know, if you were working in the CIA and you had some things you might need therapy for, you probably wouldn't go to a therapist and say, "Oh, you know, I was in Afghanistan last week and it's so stressful." But with energy psychology, you don't have to know what the other person is having trouble with. You go through a series of procedures where you find out where the distress is in their electromagnetic field, and then you stimulate it, usually just by tapping, and then you ask the person for subjective judgment if that is, you know, better. And you don't just let them tell you it's better. You can do things where you use kinesthesiology. You can have them hold out their arm and tell them that if you think it's false, let your arm go limp. If you think what I'm saying is true, then give resistance.
Huh. And you see the difference. We're going to come back. Gerald, what a fast night. We're going to take phone calls with you. Psychic vampires, clairvoyance, plants that feel stimulus.